Hello and welcome to In Real Life, the podcast brought to you by the Big Picture Film Club. This week's guest had his first career breakthrough with Hollyoaks. Since then, he's had a myriad of TV roles, including Toast of London and Ben Elton's Upstart Crow, and more recently, Outlander. His film accolades include The King's Speech, Paddington, The Mercy, and most recently War Machine, alongside Brad Pitt. He's also an accomplished comedy writer. Tim Downey, warmest greetings
Hello.
To you. I can't believe we've managed to pin you down with your busy schedule. You're in the middle of shooting, is it series five?
Series five, yeah.
Of Outlander.
So this is my second series, their fifth.
Wow.
Of Outlander. So, yes, a lot of standing around on Highland Glens.
Where is it
around.
Being filmed?
Scotland.
Okay.
It is in Scotland, so we're in all over the place. Much like we did last season. So yes, uphill, down dale, into very old castles, things like that. Which was great. It's great fun.
And sort of historic old genres are kind of your thing, aren't they?
Yes.
There's a little bit of a pattern there.
Yes. My father has always said to me that I suit a top hat. It's the only hat that doesn't make my head look like a pea for some reason. Maybe it's the height, I don't know.
If my memory serves me correctly, you got married in a top hat too, didn't you?
Yeah, my great grandfather's top hat, who was the mayor of Luton.
Really?
Yeah. He was the mayor of Luton. I don't know if they know that, if that's still a thing. But it was his top hat that he got married in, and then my father got married in it. And so did I.
Lovely.
Look at that.
Aww,
yes.
That's wonderful. So you grew up in Hitching, Hertfordshire with mm-hmm. your two sisters.
Yes.
And then you studied at the Mountview Academy of Theatre Arts, mm-hmm. is what it's called now, where alumni include Eddie Marson and Joanna Christie. Mm-hmm. And your first TV show was for Children's BBC alongside yes. James Corden.
Yes.
How yeah. did that come about?
Well, it was both our first real jobs. Called Out of Tune, about a choir that can't sing, hence Out of Tune. You see how that works. And I played a character called Street, and he played a character called Lee, who was kind of like a punk character, sort of white face, slightly clownish. It was all very, very strange. But yeah, really, really great fun. Very silly, very anarchic. And a great kind of first gig. And it just so happened that it was James, me, I think Jane Danson was in it, who was then in Coronation Street, and there was Charlie Brooks, who then were doing EastEnders. So people have gone on to kind of do some weird and wonderful things from that show. But yeah, it was great fun. Very strange. I remember one episode where they had a real crocodile on a kid's show. Just, they said, we're going to let loose a crocodile. And it was about yay big. And the thing had to kind of walk across... You know, we all had to come in and go, oh, there's a crocodile. And literally walking and go, oh my God, there is a crocodile.
Oh my goodness.
But little did we know.
One of your first cast members was a crocodile.
Was a crocodile. But little did we know is that if you put a crocodile under lights, it goes to sleep.
Does it?
So it comes in with a lot of aggression and then goes,
that's why there are a lot of unsatisfied children going to the London Aquarium or the zoo. And
but
so
they're quick. You don't want to go, it's like a firework. You don't want to go up to it. You don't want to prod a crocodile because it will go for you and it's quite...
Oh, that's funny.
It's quite terrifying, so yeah.
Interesting. So obviously you and James Corden are both comedy actors. Was comedy always something that you thought
yes.
about?
Yeah. Always, I think it's always been one of those things that's ever since I was a kid, my father is a huge comedy fan, and so we were literally brought up on a diet of Ealing comedies, Gainsborough comedies, all of these kind of great comedies from the 1940s, 1950s, they were just literally on a spool. And so I think it just gets into your blood, it gets into your bones. Just the way that you kind of look at things in everyday life, you're always kind of looking for like, well, what's the funny way of doing this? How can I do this? Because you've seen it and you kind of want to imitate it and you kind of want to play around with it. And it was the same with things like Monty Python. That was literally the things I would just watch absolutely constantly on a reel. If I had a choice, put a VHS in Python or Little Shop
they
of
do.
Horrors.
You get these wonderful
you know.
Belly laughs from Monty Python, and I think a lot of people have a lot of nostalgia about those shows growing up of a certain age, obviously. And so a typical sort of weekend, you know, rainy weekend in the Downey household will have sort of Ealing comedies, Peter Sellers, Terry Thomas, Alec Guinness.
Anything with Alec Guinness.
They are true artists, aren't
Lavender
they?
Hill Mobs, Lady Killers. Oh, goodness me. And also Will Hay was a great fan, a great one in our house. There's a film called Old Mr. Porter, which we absolutely adored. Again, was on a spool. There's an Arthur Askey film called The Ghost Train. You can see her in it, which is about a phantom train that kind of comes through and these people are trapped in this train station overnight. Again, it's like it's a light-hearted comedy, but it was written by a guy called Arnold Ridley, who you would know from being Corporal Godfrey from Dad's Army.
He's
the guy that wrote The Ghost Train, and he was a very famous writer and playwright, and wrote The Ghost Train, which again I was like, oh my god, that's absolutely extraordinary. I never knew this.
Yeah,
the comedy
and
links, you know.
And like Kind Hearts and Coronets, that kind of covers two passions of yours, which is obviously comedy, but also death and gore
and darkness.
And I'm aware that your favourite day of the year is Halloween. You're very excited about things like that.
It's the only thing we used to celebrate in our house. And it was like Christmas, birthdays and Halloween.
The first two are obligatory.
Well, absolutely, you have to. I still love all of them. Dearly.
Well, you like dressing up. You're someone definitely
I do love
like.
A bit of dressing up.
Exactly.
You know what I mean? I am an Englishman. I do like a bit of dressing up when it comes to it. You know that.
When you were 21, you landed a part in Hollyoaks. Mm-hmm. Now, is it somewhat of a relief when you land a part in something like a soap opera where you're getting regular work as opposed to worrying about when the next job's going to come from?
Yeah, it is. You know, it was one of those things that managed to pay off a lot of debts from drama school, and it really helped in that respect. I wasn't in it for that long. I was probably only in it for just over a year, maybe something like that. But it was really good in that respect. James Gordon was in that as well, hilariously enough.
He was.
He was also in Hollyoaks just before I came. So we're following each other. but it was good fun. It teaches you a lot in the sense that, you know, we were doing sort of 14 pages a day. It's like half an episode a day. And you would get the scripts the night before, so you kind of learn to kind of write, okay, you've got to make character choices quite quick, and how you're going to do it. You only have very, very limited time.
It's kind of good training and
good training.
Into the swing of things.
It is good training, yeah, very much. But then you hang it kind of like to play different things and do different things.
Of course,
and
it's,
like that.
And it's quite regimented.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. You can do certain things, but you know, you've got to get through it, basically. Mm.
And your next few years were spent doing a lot of theatre, mm-hmm. Particularly comedy theatre, and you sort of started writing as well. And on the set of one of the shows you're in, you met your wonderful wife, Jenny, who was an agent for one of the other cast members.
That's right.
To the play Charlie and Henry, I think it was.
That's right.
Which are code names for... yes. And you now, with Jenny, have two daughters, and you live in Notting Hill altogether. Mm-hmm. Is Notting Hill somewhere that you absolutely love? Most people who I speak to who live there would never live anywhere else.
It's great. Yeah, it's really great. It took me a while to get used to it because I'd moved from South London, so I was used to South London and that way of dealing with things. And Notting Hill was a bit, oh, blimey, like I made the mistake one day when we first moved in, of saying, well, I was going to go and get some milk or something like that. And I was gone for about 45 minutes. I just went to the shop and I can't move because it's Portobello Road. And I don't know quite where I'm going now. I'm lost even though
you're in the gate, the languages
out.
And the tourists. It was the shuffling
just the
tourists.
Strangest thing I've ever seen in my entire life. I need to get over there. I'm going here. Oh, okay. Very strange. And ending up in a haberdasher's. Very strange.
And around this time you started writing, and I think I've heard you say before that you starting to write has got a lot to do with the support that Jenny gave you.
Yeah, very much. Very, very much.
And what would you say is the piece of work that you think you're most proud of?
It's tricky. I would say I'm most proud of my very first piece, which was done for the Alborough Festival, which was called The Dead Moon, which was about... it was set in the Anglian Fens, and it was about smuggling, that kind of period, like the Napoleonic era, about smugglers on the fens. But it weaved in a lot of folklore of the time. So a lot of things like the will-o'-the-wisps on the fens and the marshes, where the locals were not supposed to... You were not supposed to look at the will-o'-the-wisp. If you looked at the will-o'-the-wisp, then you would sink into the marshes. But in reality, it was smugglers' tails holding up lamps, and it was the lamps moving through as they were bringing in goods. So obviously you didn't want to see it, because if you saw it, then they would, then you could tell that, oh yes, I saw these guys doing this and this. So it's weaving in that folklore and things about fairy lore and things like that.
And this wonderful darkness that you're always drawn to.
Absolutely, absolutely. And I found that absolutely fascinating. And then to put that into a play and kind of putting it within a social context as well, I found really, really rewarding. I'm very proud of that.
Did you direct that as well? You have a director's role?
No. Okay. Just purely as a writer. We did a lot of workshops for it. Workshopped it a lot beforehand, performed it a little bit just to kind of get the shape and feel of it, and then released it to the Aubrey Festival, the first non-operatic play to be performed at the Aubrey Festival. Oh, wow. I hasten to add.
Well, that's a very good accolade to have, isn't it? Right. Yeah, notable. Do you think that comedy is something you'll always never be far away from?
Yeah, I think
so. Or do you think it is something that you'd like to sort of try and veer and continually kind of look to other things?
I think it's always going to be there. It's so kind of ingrained in the very marrow of me. And I think real life has comedic moments, even then, because that's how we get through things. If everything was just, oh God, you'd never get out of bed. Yeah. So I think it's part and parcel of everything we do. It's part and parcel of being human.
I think a lot of people say that comedy can only exist because there is an element of truth in the matter.
Absolutely.
And I think that's a really true...
And it's a very honest form, and it's the only way, especially in today's climate, where you can actually pose questions and hopefully get people to think about certain things. You look at certain comedians and certain TV shows that are on and certain movies, and they pose very interesting social questions in the guise of... this is comedy.
And for want of a better word, masking, but not masking in a word.
Yeah, and I think
the
does
social
that.
Kind of...
And I think that's important. I think you've got to be, in this day and age, you've got to be asking those questions. And I think if comedy can do that as well as be funny, then it's doing its job.
It's ticking lots of boxes, entertaining, teaching, learning, questioning.
Yes.
Yeah, food for thought. Mm. So in 2010, you landed a part in The King's Speech. Mm-hmm. And I know there's a cliche about working with big stars, and you worked with Michael Gambon and Guy Pearce, amongst others, in this film. What is it like working with people like that who are so incredibly experienced and carry a lot of weight to their name?
It's a joy, especially being in the same room as Michael Gambon. And my first experience of Michael Gambon was him talking to me about Cars. Mm. I think in my head I never experienced, or I never thought I would experience, that my first meeting of a great like that, I'd just be talking about, the fuel injection of his particular Ford Escort. I didn't think that would be my opening line.
It's surreal, isn't it? It's even more surreal than talking about one of his old plays or something.
Yeah, or just kind of talking about something, that's very philosophical. Yes, I'll think about that. Yeah, no, thank you for that. Which was interesting. And also, he's renowned for being trying to make you corpse, trying to make you laugh on set.
Oh, is he?
It's not his shot. So we're doing one scene where
he pulls funny faces behind the camera.
Oh, he does worse than that. We were doing a shot where we're, the king is dying, or the king is dying, it's terrible. And all the brothers, and they're all standing here going, oh my God, the king is dying. It's all very serious, it's all very kind of weighted.
Just wanted to remind the listeners that you played his youngest son.
Yes,
so
the Duke of Gloucester, so I'm the third brother. And so we're all there, daddy's dying, very sad, it's all terrible. And he's done his bit, it's magnificent what he's done. He's supposed to be kind of going slightly senile, and it's, you're kind of watching and going, this is wonderful, I'm in the same room as
this. But he really did get the senile, the hunched, sort of...
amazing.
Confused old man in the chair.
And it was wonderful, and especially when you're in the room. And then the camera turns around and asks him, there's Colin and Guy, and we're all there, it's terrible. And I've got my bit, and you're going a bit, okay, here we go, you've been here for a while, say my bit. And he's supposed to sign his name, he's signing away, saying that his sons will now look after the kingdom, because he's not in the right settlement, so he's signing his name away. And he's signing his thing, and I'm talking to him, and he turns the paper around, and it's a cock. He's just drawing a cock on the piece of paper, and he's looking at you, kind of, yeah?
Oh my goodness.
And you're going, oh, right.
And he can get away with that.
Because you can't turn around and go, sorry, Michael's drawn a cock.
Yeah.
Michael's drawn
you
a
can't
massive
tell
cock.
On it's Michael Gambon.
Come on, man. Pull yourself together. Shocking. Shocking.
How did you cope with that? Did you stop just have picking to, out hairs from your from your legs? Did you just stop pinching yourself?
Yeah, you just kind of go, wasn't expecting that. Still trying to look sad. Or
that something. Is the greatest test for an actor, I think.
It is. It is. You don't want to be facing that with a wall going, we're losing the light. What's he doing? Get on with it. Yeah, very funny. Very funny.
Brilliant. Oh, gosh. Good sense of humour as well. Insane acting skills. Since then, you've been in Paddington, the movie where you play the explorer who finds Paddington, and The Mercy alongside Colin Firth once more, and more recently, War Machine, which is a Netflix film with Brad Pitt.
Yes.
Brad Pitt looks... I haven't seen the film. I really, really want to soon. But it's sort of his role sort of kind of reminds me a little bit about his role in Glorious Bastards. That sort of pastiche.
Yeah.
Kind of it's slightly comic but not role kind of thing. A kind of slightly
it's slightly heightened.
Yes, and working with the essence of what he's supposed to deliver and the role he's supposed to play and perform and reflect.
Yeah.
And get people to kind of reflect and question obviously what's going on in the in the subject matter of the
film. And again, that's another good example of what, because that's a satire of what comedy can do in the sense that it's holding the mirror up and kind of saying this is the world you're in and this is what it looks like. This is behind the curtain. This is what it's like. And these are the people that you've got in charge to do all these quite sensitive dealings. And if people have, and you kind of look at them going, are you serious that that man is going into that room to deal with this?
In a nutshell, the plot is they're sent to Afghanistan to rebuild community there.
Yeah. Yeah, and it's based around a Rolling Stone article where a Rolling Stone journalist went up to this general who was notorious apparently for just kind of just going bleh and just telling everything as he sees it. So then that guy wrote a book, and that's what the film is on. But it's about American involvement in and their foreign policy and how they go into war zones or areas that have just had conflict and how they deal with it. So for instance, my sort of part is that I'm a Washington sort of pen pusher, a diplomat that's just literally been kind of, he's just spent all his time in like Washington or Baltimore and has just been thrown into this Afghan village that's growing opium and trying to persuade these farmers that they shouldn't be growing opium, it's very bad growing opium, and they should be growing something like cotton. But US foreign policy works it that if they were to grow cotton, then they would be putting those on the world markets. And if they went on to the world markets, they would be up against American growers. Right. So they would earn no money whatsoever because of sanctions that are in place. So actually it's far better to just grow opium because the price is higher. But foreign policy, and it was
of
interesting
course,
that...
And the detrimental effects of
absolutely,
that.
Absolutely, absolutely. Yeah. And then seeing how to try and pull the strings to go, no, you don't want to be flooding American markets with opium, you want to be doing cotton, which would probably give you nothing for.
And of course, this is a microcosm of the problems that exist today.
Exactly.
In reality, in the world, and especially coming from America.
Yeah.
Amazing.
No, it's great. It's good. Really good film.
And it was a Netflix film.
Yes.
And my question to you is, not being personally familiar with film sets, is there a difference with working on a Netflix film to working on a non-Netflix film?
No, there really isn't. It was still big and sprawling.
Yeah.
And, you know, it had anything and everything you could possibly.
But now they almost seem that much more desirable because there's this sort of less, because I think there's a little bit more of a kind of artistic ride and there's a bit more money available now with Netflix.
Yeah.
I think that's the kind of general.
Yes, they seem to have
idea.
Yeah,
yeah,
a budget.
Exactly, and of course Netflix films are doing so incredibly well now. Mm. Roma really swept up at the Oscars recently. And what are your thoughts on the Netflix backlash from the industry, where you know some people feel that Netflix films shouldn't be considered for awards, awards like the traditional theatrical released films.
Yeah, I think we're moving into a time where, you know, nothing is as it once was. You know, we are moving. You know, you can get movies on your phone now. Who thought, you know, when I was growing up, that would ever be a reality? Maybe I might have seen it in Total Recall, where suddenly there was like a video phone. But I think platforms are changing, things are changing. The very nature of cinema itself is constantly in flux. If you can imagine, cinema's only been around for like 120-something years.
Mm.
And you think from the very first Georges Méliès films and the kind of super sort of special effects they were doing then as compared to now, it's a world apart. And it's constant change and constant flux. And I think if you're making good work, if the stories are there, if you've got the performers and the crews and the passion to make film, then I think, you know, anything and everything should be considered. There's some extraordinary low budget movies that may only get released in one or two cinemas. I think they should be as lauded and as viewed as much as the biggest Avenger film or the biggest studio back film that you can that you can think of. I think it's all about story and performance and art, and I think, yeah, if that's on Netflix or Sky or BBC Two, then they should all be considered. It is all art at the end of the day. It's all film.
Yeah.
It's all storytelling.
Yeah. And with digital platforms now, do you think it's easier to get recognised within the industry now, in both writing and acting, as opposed to when you started?
I don't know. I think because now there is a lot of platform and a constant need for content. That I think what's happening
is you're sort of including YouTube and things like that in that social media.
Yeah, I think the view has shifted. Whereas, you know, when I was kind of just come out of drama school, everything was in its infancy, so it was still quite old school in the way that things would be done. You know, there wasn't.
Yeah, you wouldn't have a website.
You wouldn't have a website. You wouldn't have a YouTube channel. You wouldn't have any of these extraneous things. You'd just have kind of be you. You'd almost like go around with a paper CV and a photo and kind of hand it in, and that was kind of how you would do things. How they did things from like the 60s onward. It was no real difference, but I think it's opened everything up. I think it gives chance to voices that hopefully would not necessarily be heard, so I think that's really important. But I think also it can sometimes skew and shift things. Like now, if you're going to get cast just purely on Twitter followers, that's a different thing to just being cast on your talent or what you're going to bring to a project. So, but I think, you know, parameters move and change, and it's still kind of relatively new, and it's constantly in flux and constant change. So we'll see how it happens. Everyone's got to move. You know, everything has to move and adapt, as they say in the Woody Allen film. You know, it's a shark. You know, you've just got to keep going, because if you stop, then you die. You know,
and you don't
want a dead shark on your hands.
No, of course not.
You don't want that.
You're a Woody Allen fan?
I am a Woody Allen fan, which is controversial. It's very controversial to say.
I'm a huge Woody Allen fan, so don't worry.
Growing up, he was a great influence on me. He was that comedy and what he did, and yeah, it was a huge influence from Annie Hall, from Hannah and the Sisters.
I think his scripts are wonderful. I'm a very script-led person.
Yeah.
I really am a sucker for a good script, and I just think that his are so sharp, razor sharp.
Yeah, they were great.
Every sentence, every word means something, or even a tut or a noise he makes has relevance, and I love that about him.
Yeah, and he's a great storyteller. Controversial now.
Yeah, of course.
But some of his work is amazing, and it has influenced comedy enormously.
Yeah.
You know, from Seinfeld to Frasier to
All American.
All these kind of great, you know, American series and films do owe something to that early Woody Allen.
And I think I love it. I also love Woody Allen plays on the theatre. I think they really get something out of them.
I only remember Play It Again, Sam. That's the only one I remember. I know some more.
I think that's the best one, probably.
You're probably right.
Yeah. Bit of Humphrey Bogart in there as well. Love Humphrey Bogart. So in 2011, 2012, you came to the attention of wider audiences in the TV series This Is Jinsey, and in the sitcom alongside David Jason in The Royal Bodyguard.
Oh, yes.
Where you play the hapless Yates, I think.
That's
He's
right.
always at the butt of David Jason's sort of clumsiness,
yes,
as it were. How was it working with him?
It was really good. It's quite something, because
he's more of a TV actor.
More of a TV actor.
In comparison to Michael Gambon.
But extraordinary, because again, you've grown up with with him. You know, you've seen him as Del Boy, you've seen him in you know, Open All Hours and so on. So then to work with him is quite, oh, okay, you know, see how this works out. But it was great fun. It's great fun, very relaxed on set, and it was interesting, very, you know, working out the subtleties and seeing how he kind of does something. And it's very physical. Like, he's always been known as a physical comic, and I enjoy a lot of physical comedy as well. I think I can be quite good at it.
Can you define physical comedy?
Physical comedy is, I think, being able to fall down and get up again very quickly. And if you can do that and retain some sort of dignity, then it's fine. It's physical. So whereas comedy can be quite verbal, as in joke, 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 this is being able to do something, kind of stems from old school clowning and mime and things like that.
So you say slapstick is under this category?
Yeah, slapstick's very definitely physical comedy. And if it's done well, it's like a ballet and can be done beautifully. And he's always been known for being very physical in his comedy, so that was a great learning curve again for me to kind of watch that and go, oh, okay, that's very interesting. How can you fall down and get up without hurting yourself? You know, he's a man in his later years, so you know, how do you do that? How can you do that? And it's technique, and it's how you fall and how you get up, the timing of the thing, and that's very interesting to see. And again, a different aspect of comedy.
So you have a role in the upcoming Horrible Histories, the movie.
Yes,
and that is going to be out
July.
In July,
yes.
Okay. And again, it's amazing. You've got this wonderful span of, you know, you've been in a lot of period things and a lot of comedy and children's, and this is sort of back to sort of children's and comedies again.
Yeah.
Children and comedy.
And it's a brilliant script. It's very funny. It has echoes of Monty Python. It has echoes of all of those kind of old school comedy that it's like, again, bit of physical comedy, as well as just some good gags. And it's a musical as well. There's some songs. I don't sing, thankfully. You don't want to hear that.
You were in Les Mis.
I was in Les Mis. I was in Les Mis. Well, I can sing. But if I can avoid it, then I will. I feel that's best for any viewer. You don't really want to hear that. You're all right. Go and see Hugh Jackman do it. Much better.
So could you recommend something that you've seen recently that you think is a must-see? For listeners,
something I've seen recently.
It can be a series or a film.
I saw the other day, literally I just finished watching it the other day, the new Daisy Haggard series called Back to Life.
Okay.
Which is on BBC iPlayer. It was on BBC Three. But that I thought was brilliant. Really, really good. About a woman coming out of prison. She spent 18 years in prison, and it's her trying to get herself back to life, as it were. Like, she's moving back to a small seaside town, and how the people react to her, a comedy, and how the people react to her trying to start a life.
Interesting, it's a comic spin on something that is actually quite a brutal subject in
Very
a way.
Very brutal, and it is dark, and it is hard to watch in certain places, but it is also very uplifting. It's just a really brilliant piece of TV, really beautifully written, beautifully shot. There's some real great shots of sort of, I think I was describing it to my wife by saying, like the Detectorists. The Detectorists kind of did these beautiful shots of meadows or of insects on things, and it really gave you a kind of feel of time and place. And this does something very similar to that, but has a kind of like psychogeography shots of, so it's things like power stations or just kind of empty beaches and the sea. So there's a bleakness to it, and you do feel like you're on the edge of something. So there's that as well as the script as well. So yeah, it's a really, that
so
I would
back
heartily...
Back to Life on
back
iPlayer.
Back to Life on iPlayer, I would heartily recommend.
And what film, if you could only watch one film again for the rest of your life, what would it be?
That is almost
I know it's a
impossible.
Slightly unfair question.
It's almost impossible. What would I watch? I don't
All right, I'll give you three then.
Give me three. All right. Then in that case, I would say... I would say The Seventh Seal, Bergman's Seventh Seal, because I've probably watched that about 7 or 8 times throughout the course.
And
has that
influenced your sort of love of the dark side of things?
Yeah, it has.
It's from this film, isn't it, where death it has been pastiched so many times.
Absolutely, yeah. The knight on the shore playing
a man,
against,
i.e.,
playing
a man with
death.
A pale face wearing a black robe and hood. Gant with a sickle.
Yeah, and trying to outwit Death by playing a game of chess on the shore. And then Death just keeps appearing
more recently, now and then. Bill and Ted, obviously.
Yeah, massively, playing battleships.
Yeah.
Yes, very, very much. but I remember seeing that film and thinking, oh, this is just, it came out about 1962. It's a black and white foreign language film. And you kind of think, oh, God, this is going to be quite heavy. And yet the kind of, the wit, it was so adult. It was one of the most adult films I'd ever seen. It was dealing with death and it was dealing with love and sex and these really dark themes, and yet elevating it to this almost like folkloric kind of view of this particular period, like set in the medieval period during the plagues and around a set of travelling players that move from town to town, and death just kind of keeps on appearing. I just thought this is the most extraordinary piece of filming I think I've ever seen, and still I think to this day it's storytelling at its finest. It's not doing too much, it's not overlaying you with too many things, too many special effects or all of these things. There's just some extraordinary sequences. There's a sequence where they're going to crucify a witch, and it's all told through smoke as this woman is carrying this cross, and there's this kind of parade of carts and monks donging bells, and you just kind of catch little bits of this woman kind of dragging it in, and then the knight appears and then death appears, and you kind of, it's the most extraordinary thing I've ever seen.
Sort of 50s special effects.
Yeah, but it's very subtle. I think they knew what they could do. But it's a guy called Sven Nykvist, who was Bergman's cinematographer, and he did pretty much all of his sort of middle period with him. And he just has a certain look and a certain way of shooting things. Well, you don't have to see everything. You just can see little bits here and there. They did a film called The Silence, which is about two sisters moving into a hotel. And there's a sequence in that where one sister's very ill, and another sister goes off, has had no real kind of contact with any men, and this man starts showing her interest. So they go off to this little hut by the side of the railway, and this sex scene is played out just with the lights of the trains passing. So it's all in darkness, and then suddenly the train will pass, and it'll just light certain parts of the face or the leg or a hand or a sheet. And you're just going to go, it's extraordinary. So it all plays out in your head, and this kind of intimacy is just where the camera moves. So you don't see everything.
Sounds amazing.
It's just very subtly played, and you get that element of...
And each shot has been really carefully considered.
There's not enough of that now.
Yeah,
and it's all about distance, and very little is said, and it's just kind of like the rattle of a glass on something. And and you get the sense of distance, and you get the sense of loneliness within things as well. It's extraordinary. So yeah, Seventh Seal, absolutely must see. Goodness me.
Well, there you go. I mean, you've picked one. I mean, you can have a quick, if you want to say your other two very quickly, you can.
What else would I choose? I genuinely would probably choose Raiders of the Lost Ark.
Oh yes, of course.
I would say that probably had one of the biggest influences to me as a kid.
One of the highest grossing films of all time.
As well it should be. Mm. I think it gave me my idea that I was going to be an explorer.
Mm-hmm.
And that sense of lost cities.
Come back at you.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
Of finding lost cities of kind of, and also my hatred of Nazis. That still continues. I mean, obviously I'm glad he got melted. I mean, who doesn't hate Nazis? So there was that, and what else was it about Raiders? It was just that whole... I mean, literally every party I went to that had a fancy dress theme growing up, I was Indiana Jones. It's as simple as that. I remember drying out the side of my lip and trying to make a little cut, because Harrison Ford had a little cut on the side of his lip. I remember being told to leave my whip, which I had made with a piece of string and some sellotape. Could I please leave that? Because that's not suitable for an eight-year-old party. I was eight at the time. Obviously, I wasn't 18 or anything trying to get in. But yeah, so I was obsessed with that sense of adventure. And that sense of adventure and exploring and mountains and lost worlds. And again, folklore. It touches upon folklore and legend. And I think that really kind of informed, sort of like brought out everything I then... have still kept and still adore to this day. I still see myself as an explorer going off to the mountains.
And ultimately, it's good versus bad and the good prevail.
Exactly. So, yeah. It's great. And, get to hold a gun and shoot the guy, which the story of that that particular scene. You know the scene where the guy comes out and he's twirling the sword around? He's twirling the sword, they're in the souk in Egypt, I think they are. And he's twirling the sword around and they're getting ready. And the thing is as the story goes, is that the guy comes out and they're supposed to have a sword fight, him and Indiana Jones.
Yeah.
And they got on set and he'd left his sword. He'd left it in the trailer or something like that. So the guy was doing all that kind of crazy, crazy artistry. And then he just goes, well, I've just got to go and get out and shot him. And so they kept it in.
Oh.
It wasn't supposed to happen at all.
Unplanned.
Well,
sometimes those are the best.
And now?
Yeah.
You know, 30, 40 years later, you go, yes, that's a great scene.
Amazing. So you can catch Tim in Horrible Histories, the movie, which is out in summer. And in series 5 of Outlander.
Yes. Which I think will be out maybe the end of the year. I have no idea. We have yet to be told.
Of course, you're the last people to know, aren't you?
Absolutely, the last people to know, absolutely.
Tim, thank you so much for joining us.
Pleasure.
On In Real Life.
Pleasure.
It's been wonderful talking to you. Wish we could talk for longer, really.
Absolutely. Let's.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.